Planetary remote sensing and GIS, the convergence of software techniques and data.
Thanks. Right. I should state up front that I'm not a planetary geologist. In fact, I'm not a geologist even. Last time I took was geology was at first year at university. My co-authors are, though, not that they're here. I am a glacial geomorphologist, so the Eskers have been there, actually the most exciting thing for me to see so far. I've also slightly turned the title of the talk around. Perhaps I'd say I'm probably talking about GIS and planetary remote sensing rather than planetary remote sensing and GIS. And the talk is really more by way of a review from a GIS perspective. And it's partly because my co-author Nick needed some assistance on the GIS front that I've become far more interested in this side of things. Now, with a name like Smith, I'd just like to clear a few things up. I'm not Michael Smith. I'm also not Captain Michael Smith. Or Mike Smith, the ex-guitarist. Or finally, for those of us from the 80s, Smithy either. So, in terms of a brief introduction, geographic information systems are not new. They've been around as a digital application for around 40 years. I'm particularly interested in terms of commercial off-the-shelf, COTS, software. And the first one of those to hit the UK was ArcInfo back in 1985. And that's not me back in 1985. And it ran on a VAX 730 with a Tektronix terminal off tape drives. And this is the bit that gets me. It cost over £200,000. And in terms of what you could do with it, it took an hour just to load the equivalent of a 5 by 5 kilometre ordnance survey tile. So it's only really in the last decade or so that GIS has been readily accessible to a wide audience. And that's primarily, not surprising, the result of the PC becoming ever cheaper, as well as the software becoming cheaper. So that's where GIS fits in. Remote sensing. Well, remote sensing's not new either. We've been collecting aerial imagery like this one for over 130 years. This is Boston back in 1860. We've been collecting satellite imagery for around 50 years and interplanetary imagery for around 45 years with imagery starting with Mariner 2 and a nice shot from Mariner 4 from Mars there. So spatial analysis isn't new either, and that's been occurring for at least 150 years in terms of a written academic sense. And some of you may recognise this diagram, which is oft quoted as one of the earlier pieces of spatial analysis. This is the 1854 cholera epidemic in London, and this is Broad Street here. And they're actually these histograms here are mapping deaths, and using that they could see where clusters of deaths were. So, planetary GIS. Well, the uptake and use of GIS within geosciences has not been mirrored within planetary sciences. And that's partially due, I'm sure people can probably think of some other reasons, the origin of much of the research within astronomy, a lack of digital data, and the GIS geocentric nature of many commercial GIS. So the remainder of this presentation, I'm just really going to reflect upon how GIS, in a software sense, data and techniques are now converging and have been for 5 to 10 years. So software. In terms of data models and software, vector and raster have been the two dominant data models for handling any type of spatial data. And software has historically been focused on only one of these. So, for example, Adrizi, for those who've used it, was typically raster-based, and ArcInfo was typically vector-based or focused upon vector. These barriers are now largely eroded in terms of how commercial software has developed. In the UK, and this is perhaps most pertinent here, Esri ArcGIS and Erdos Imagine are the two products that are extensively used within remote sensing and GIS in general. And that is primarily due to the CHESS license agreements that have been negotiated for these. So obviously there are many, many more software products, but these two are very much dominant throughout HE in the UK. And much of the academic experience of GIS is based around these products and what they can do or what they can't do. Whilst I've been going on about GIS, you might actually be wondering, is it worth using it or why use it? Well, from my perspective, the power of GIS is that they can handle many large data sets in different coordinate systems and apply consistent quantitative processing to them. So the true power of GIS really comes from its ability to integrate and output different data sets but within a single coordinate system. And what does that allow you to do? Well, it allows you to do visualization, query, analysis, and perhaps from my perspective, and I'll come back to this, output as well. So often we don't see consistent output because it's far more complicated to output data sets in one consistent coordinate system. Which leads me on, very neatly, to coordinate systems. GIS are very geocentric, or Earth-based. And it is only with the latest version of ArcGIS that we have out-of-the-box planetary bodies supported. Although there have been a variety of add-on projection files going back to the mid-90s. Now that's in terms of GIS. If we're specifically interested in remote sensing, we'll note that Imagine doesn't support non-terrestrial coordinate systems at all in any way. And that's because the major and minor planetary axes are actually hard-coded into the software. So it's a major problem with Imagine in terms of remote sensing. Even with version 9, which is the latest version, which has just come out, it doesn't explicitly support them out of the box, although there are a variety of workarounds for them. And remote sensing is clearly key here. While GIS in general allows us to do our visualization, query analysis and output, if we're wanting to do anything quantitative in a remote sensing sense, this is what we're after. And it's exacerbated, particularly for Mars, by our competing coordinate systems. So we have O-graphic and O-centric coordinate systems. So even if you have one set of data, you might not be able to use it if it's the wrong type of coordinate system. And it's hoped, and the people over at astrogeology at the USGS do a lot of work on this, particularly the coordinate system side, and they've been doing some consultation with the Open Geospatial Consortium to actually try to provide a solution for this that will be generically adopted within the software industry. And not surprisingly as well, it's further compounded by the fact that we don't actually have much geodetic control outside of Earth as well. So whilst we might have some nice imagery, say from the 80s, it could be 10, 20, 30 kilometres out from imagery we collect from a modern sensor. Data. One of the big increases in the use of GIS, and that's across geosciences as a whole, has been the rapid increase in access to digital data. As an interesting aside, for Earth this has always been a problem because much of the data has been copyright to whichever organisation has collected them, although in more recent years with the release of much federal US data, within the public domain, that's become less of a problem. My impression is that more generally data is easier to use within planetary sciences. We've got panchromatic data, multispectral data, stereo data. In fact, we've got all of this data is in part due to the success of many recent missions, and I dare say it actually can be a bit overwhelming. So I did a quick take of recent missions. And it just keeps coming on and on and on. And you can actually get much of this data. So we are overwhelmed with digital data now, both for Earth and other planetary bodies. The big issue here, though, is actually processing the data. And in general, we have three broad levels of data. We have raw data as returned by the sensor, which some people term level zero. And that requires some kind of pre-processing. There may be, in terms of sensor calibration or radiometric correction. The pre-processed data then is georeferencing, so you actually know where it is, and that goes from level one up to level two. There is far, far less level two generally available just to pluck straight off a server and put into a GIS. Usually at level one you need some kind of one of either ISIS or Vicar in terms of an open source environment to pre-process the data, and that just makes life just a little bit more complicated. Terrestrial data is typically distributed from data centres as level two, and we're actually awash with it for the Earth. There's so much of it. You work out where you want the data for. And it's presented to you just to download straight away and load straight into a GIS. You don't have to do anything else with it. And it's getting better and better. GeoEye, which is a satellite due to launch next year, I think it is, will have a 40-ish centimetre pixel resolution for the Earth. The important thing here, though, is it offers geolocation accurate to around 3 metres. And that's as the product delivered to you. You don't actually have to do anything to it. So it's that kind of deliver and use, which we don't have access to. So on Earth, we have data centres such as the Global Land Cover Facility, which give us those features. So it makes using terrestrial data so much more simple, and it's because of that that its penetration across the subject has been much higher. And as I've noted, planetary level 2 data is not so easy to come by. Some of the techniques that you can apply. Well, mainstream GIS offers the potential for a simplified, inclusive working environment, or graphical environment, and within that you can then implement a whole variety of quantitative techniques. Part of the problem where errors creep in and things take longer is when you end up having to round-trip data out of one program and into another and then return it. And these can range from simple pre-processing, such as adjusting contrast or doing convolution filtering in a remote sensing sense, through to more complex analyses, such as principal components or fast Fourier transforms or whatever, which you can just handle fairly straightforwardly. My own research interest in terms of glacial geomorphology has been digital elevation models, and it has been somewhat gratifying to note that in terms of the conference anyway, this DEM seems to have, as a data source, seems to be one of the most exciting that people are using in terms of answering scientific questions. So topographic data is proving vital for understanding surface and subsurface processes. And I'd like to come back to just briefly mention MOLA in terms of providing altimetry profiles, but that's actually proved a whole lot more successful since the release of the mega data. And I also make the point that it's actually the first space-borne digital elevation model of an entire planet. So we haven't actually done it for Earth as yet for an entire planet. And, of course, we've got HRSC and HiRISE, which will provide very high resolution topographic data to augment that. So topography is used for a whole variety of purposes, and I think we've seen much of this through the conference: baseline mapping, hypsometry, elevation derivatives such as slope aspect and curvature, surface roughness, hydrological modelling. And you can implement much of that within a GIS. Or dare I say all of that. So by way of a very brief example, my co-authors selected a site to do some very quick topographic mapping, more to illustrate some of these points. And it was a region between Pavonis Mons and Olympus Mons on Mars, using the standard mega data for that area. And all we did was apply a variety of different visualisation techniques to aid the interpretation. So here we have Olympus Mons, and we were focused down in this area here. So that is just a grayscale image, which I don't think anybody uses in terms of topographic mapping. We then have a shaded relief image, which is used extensively for mapping landforms. This is an image showing slope, which gives you a different detail. And this is another algorithm called a local contrast stretch, which again picks out different types of detail. It's really to make the point that something like a grayscale image shows very little detail. Now remember, we're all dealing with exactly the same data set here. So it's in terms of how you process it. The relief shading shows quite a lot of detail, but it suffers from selective viewing angles, which is something that causes you to either accentuate certain land surface features or diminish them. The slope and local contrast stretch depict much, much greater detail and don't suffer from these selected viewing angles. This isn't my slide, so I'll just repeat it, but don't ask me any questions about it. evidence for both impact deformation and eruption. Linear features running north-south could be collapsed dikes. And this is Nick's input. He's potentially interested in using some of these as inputs to finite element modelling in order to quantify cone collapse and lithospheric stress fields. GIS provides an environment to integrate the morphology and the numerical modelling together. So in terms of some brief conclusions, GIS has been adopted for many terrestrial studies, but it's used far less in planetary sciences, partly due to the geocentric nature of much GIS and the previous lack of data. But the full advantage can be made of research methodologies when combined with remotely sensed modelling and techniques for terrain modelling. Just a couple of brief thoughts. Much is going on in the planetary sciences. I found it very interesting not being a planetary geologist coming here. Working in a GIS group, I didn't know if there was any interest or if there was any kind of special interest group within remote sensing GIS specifically for planetary sciences to look at some of these issues. And I would just like to make a small plug as well, and this comes back to the output side of things, to the Journal of Maps, which I started as a non-profit open access journal. And we publish maps which otherwise wouldn't be accepted because of their size or colour electronically. And this is an example of Pete's map, which was published earlier this year. Thanks very much.